This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick.
Al, you've been away for so long, it's felt like centuries. We've started a summer series, and it's called California Dreaming. Our blog is called Daydreaming. Isn't that catchy?
Yes, very good. Okay.
We've been looking at the faltering economy by examining how it's affecting the California dream. And, you know, many people think of California as this great place to escape the East Coast, the cold.
It is.
Yeah, it is. Oh, you did that. And settle down in a sprawling ranch-style home in the burbs. But Californians are defaulting on their home loans, are spending hundreds of dollars filling up their gas tanks.
Yeah, still, it is the place of innovation and even optimism still, isn't it?
It is. And today on California Dreaming, we are profiling an innovator, an optimist. He goes by the name of Mr. Jalopy. Here's how he describes himself: mediocre welder, fair mechanic, and clumsy designer.
That could be a lot of us.
From his workshop in Los Angeles, right off Interstate 5, Mr. Jalopy is helping lead what's called the makers movement. It's a trend that may transform the way we use the things we buy. NPR's Celeste Headlee has more.
Mr. Jalopy's garage is lined with cabinets filled with parts, an unimaginable number of widgets, wires, and springs, all carefully labeled and stored in case he needs them to fix a garage sale purchase. Over here is a station wagon that he's tricked out with Christmas lights, and here is a polished wooden cabinet that he transformed into an MP3 player.
I wanted to listen to a Dinah Washington song that I knew that I had on an album, and I thought, why should I keep buying the same music over and over every time a new format comes out?
So he took a beautiful Art Deco radio, circa 1940 or so, fitted it with an iPod and an LCD panel from an old computer monitor, and then rewired the whole thing so he could transfer his music from LPs to MP3s.
I've taken a portable iPod, made a giant iPod, eliminates all that mugging risk that they were talking about early on.
I see the rest of Hoopty Rides, Inc.
Nearby is what he calls his urban guerrilla movie theater. It's a sturdy wooden box mounted on a Schwinn adult tricycle.
Instead of bemoaning the end of the drive-in movie theater in Southern California, I decided to make my own drive-in movie theater so that I can enjoy it with my friends.
His theater travels anywhere and projects movies onto a 12-foot screen. Mr. Jalopy is a maker, a combination artist, tinkerer, and craftsman who's inspired by what he finds at garage sales. Artist Nemo Gould is stirred by his discoveries at the San Francisco dump.
Everything you've got in your home I've seen at the dump, in any state of repair imaginable, perhaps sealed in a box and brand new.
Gould is a kinetic sculptor that makes robots and shiny, sleek scooters out of discarded objects. He's also a maker. And both he and Jalopy are part of the growing makers movement in California. Dale Doherty says it starts with simple questions.
What could I do with my first generation digital camera, or second generation digital camera, or my first iPod? I mean, they're lying in a closet somewhere. I could do something interesting with them. That it's part of the assets we have at hand. Why not use them somehow?
And he says that leads to learning how to reuse and reimagine objects you already own. Doherty is the editor of Make magazine.
On a very simple level, I think the maker movement is sort of identifying yourself by the things that you make, and that could be dinner.
But on a more complicated level, the makers movement is about more than creating cool rockets or braided rugs. It's also a philosophical idea about what ownership really means. Mr. Jalopy defined this with a maker's Bill of Rights that he wrote in 2005, when he tried to replace the batteries in his iPod and found the case glued shut.
If you're not able to open and replace the batteries in your iPod or replace the fuel sender switch on your Chevy truck, you don't really own it. The terms of ownership are still dictated by the company that assembled it and glued the iPod shut so that you couldn't get into it.
The list of 17 directives includes: if it snap shut, it shall snap open, and ease of repair shall be a design ideal, not an afterthought. Nemo Gould says he wants to return to the days of the 1950s, when people kept things for years and didn't toss them out when they broke.
A lot of average suburban men would have a metal lathe in their garage. That's something that you can't even conceive of today. But it was sort of common, oh, well, if my lawnmower breaks, I'll want to fix it, won't I?
Although the makers movement started with a few techno geeks, artists, and hobbyists, it's attracted thousands of people who never considered themselves handy. Bay Area-based Make magazine has a circulation of 110,000, and a record 65,000 people waited in two-hour traffic jams to get to the Maker's Fair just outside San Francisco.
There's a paradigm shift definitely occurring, but these are not paradigm shifts that have never occurred in society.
Joseph Lopez works at the ACT Lab at the University of Texas, where their entire purpose is to make stuff.
You know, in third world countries, they do this all the time. You know, they have cars and they can't just go get the part from AutoZone. They have to just be creative and make it. And there's a whole culture behind making parts for your car that don't belong in your car.
And while the maker's mentality is spreading to mechanics in the U.S., Mr. Jalopy's philosophy has caught the attention of some major corporations. Jalopy has consulted with Disney, Apple, and others, preaching the gospel of open-source manufacturing. He tells them to use screws instead of glue, to make schematics readily available. For technology companies, create forums for consumers to share ideas. For car companies, sell patterns so people can make car seat covers. He says it's about changing with the times.
You have to be ready for when your competition does open the doors and does start engaging with consumers in the way that they want to do business. Because they're going to, and then you're going to have to figure out how to catch up.
Jalopy says when a company engages with consumers, they get passionate advocates of their products, true believers that will give them free publicity and increase sales with very little effort. He says it's worked beautifully for Apple's iPod.
I'm sure there are other MP3 players out there, but who even knows what they are? Nobody even cares, because the true believers have made the iPod the brand that it is.
And many of those true believers are driving the makers movement. Mr. Jalopy says there's a real sense of satisfaction when you've made something yourself, when you've had an active hand in repairing, adapting, or transforming a broken egg timer into something useful.
And these objects that are out there at garage sales waiting for you right now, this Saturday, get up at 7 o'clock, go out there and start looking for these objects, have already lived these incredible lives with people. These inspired objects that have caught sparks of the owners that had them.
Jalopy says in the end, the makers movement isn't so much about what you may find at someone's yard sale as it is about becoming resourceful and developing a stronger relationship with the things that you own. Celeste Headlee, NPR News.
As the name suggests, Mr. Jalopy, he loves old cars, and one of his favorites is an old yellow Camaro he's called Sister Golden Hair Surprise. Well, last week we asked you to send us a picture of your car and to tell us what it says about you. Go to our blog and check yourself out. You can also see Sister Golden Hair Surprise there. She's a beaut.
NPR.org/daydreaming. This is what you've been doing?
More to come on Day to Day.
This week on Morning Edition, we're meeting mystery writers who write about where they live. Today, NPR's Andrea De Leon takes us to the nation's easternmost city, where rugged coves and weather clapboard houses provide a perfect setting for murder.
Sarah Graves' novels, all dozen of them, take place here in Eastport, Maine, an island connected to the mainland by a long causeway. Sarah Graves first traveled that causeway over a decade ago. Back then, she went by her given name of Mary Squibb. She was a commercial writer ready to ditch Manhattan. The first Eastport mystery was in her head, all ready to write before she moved to town.
I have no idea how I expected that to happen, but I just expected that it would happen, and then we moved here and it did. It was fate.
But like most islands, Eastport is tightly knit, its bonds made tighter by hard work and difficult weather. Then one day this writer arrives with her husband from New York. People noticed.
My very dear friends lived across the street from her, so we watched her from day one.
Mary Pottle owns a local real estate agency.
Oh, must have been something exciting over there going on. We couldn't see in the windows. New people in the neighborhood.
Someone showing up in a strange car with out-of-state plates? It sounds like something borrowed from the beginning of one of Graves' own mysteries.
The light dawned suddenly. My old book, a sudden death. And now this stranger, arriving without warning.
In the books, such a stranger would inevitably wind up entangled with Graves' reluctant sleuth, Jacobia Tiptree, Jake to her friends. Graves and her character have a lot in common. Both moved to Eastport to escape the fast life in New York, and both are fixing up old Eastport houses. Jake would prefer to spend her time glazing windows or taking a sledgehammer to the ancient upstairs commode, hence the name of the series, Home Repair is Homicide. But it wouldn't be a mystery book if someone didn't turn up dead, and quickly. And Sarah Graves wouldn't be a mystery writer if she couldn't spot means, motive, and opportunity as she drives around town.
Now we are going out to the end of Water Street, to the end of what's called Dog Island, to overlook Passamaquoddy Bay.
There's a beckoning glimpse of the Atlantic, dotted with fur-covered islands, and a view to the shoreline of New Brunswick, Canada. In any other part of the country, this kind of coastline would be buzzing with jet skis and other pleasure craft. But Graves says, not so fast.
You're completely at the mercy of the ocean if you just put one foot wrong and it catches you. It looks so pretty and so romantic. And in fact, it's just absolutely deadly. You can live about 15 minutes if you fall in. Not because you will drown, but because your body will just slow down and stop from the cold.
And as a writer who occasionally needs to kill somebody...
Works great. Absolutely.
Jake Tiptree herself almost succumbs to the icy water when she gets into a skiff with a con man named Rickert in this scene from the book Nailbiter.
Rickert swung the oar. This time the flat blade connected with my shoulder the way a bat hits a ball, lifting me and carrying me over the rail. The last thing I saw was his face watching impassively as I splashed down. Then came the sudden roar of the outboard as he motored away, leaving me in the icy water, kicking and flailing, drowning.
To read the books, Eastport seems to be a pretty dangerous place, and just like in the books, there's a big police station right on Main Street in the center of town. Anybody there? No answer. The only cop on duty is later spotted flying by Bayside Mobile, blue lights flashing. Bill Wentworth pauses at the gas pump to note the action.
The highlight of our day, some poor bugger gets a speeding ticket. Not too much goes on here.
Wentworth can't remember the last time there was a real murder in Eastport. Someone recalls a shooting that happened back in the 60s. There's a little breaking and entering from time to time. But Eastport is a place where the customers have their own key to the local breakfast joint, and they open it up to make their own coffee every morning. The town has more than its share of empty storefronts, but business seems brisk at one of Sarah Graves' favorite shops.
And here we are at Wadsworth's Hardware Store.
Wadsworth's exists in both the real Eastport and the fictional Eastport. Both Graves and her character, Jake Tiptree, spend a lot of time here.
But I have always liked this stuff. Little scrapers and little blades, razor... Of course I like little blades. Mystery writers all like little blades. Little foam paint brushes and drop cloths and... I don't even know what some of this stuff is, and I want it.
Wadsworth's even sells the Home Repair is Homicide series. The books are displayed along with the wrenches and saws in the front window. Cashier Winnie Higgins says locals love to read about their town.
If you live here in Eastport, you could say, oh, that's the city manager she's talking about. I mean, I'm just using that as an example. Because this is a small town, I don't want to get in any trouble.
Graves insists that, with two well-known exceptions, all of her characters are fictional. But nobody believes her. What they do believe is that Sarah Graves' books and the occasional tourists they bring are good for Eastport. The books feel cozy, just like the town. When Jake Tiptree isn't solving crimes, she's fretting over whether she has enough guest towels for a lady's tea, or who will help her dislodge the cast-iron bathtub she's gotten wedged in the upstairs landing.
I did once say in Jake's voice that in Eastport, when you need help, people will help you. You don't always have to be thinking about that to know that it's true, and that frees you up to count your punch cups if you need to.
The Eastport Sarah Graves ladles up for her readers is picturesque, but not picture perfect. A lot like the Eastport you find when you drive down that long causeway to the island, give or take a few dead bodies. Andrea De Leon, NPR News.
You can read an excerpt from Sarah Graves' novel, The Book of Old Houses, in the book section of our website at npr.org. Our series, Crime in the Cities, continues tomorrow, and we head south to the Big Easy.
They say that New Orleans must be a great place to write mysteries because there's so much crime there. And I always sort of have to laugh and say, oh yeah, that's just great. But of course, that has nothing to do with it. It's all about the secrets.
Author Julie Smith finds New Orleans and its secrets the perfect setting for her novels. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We've heard about crackdowns on graffiti and on the people who create graffiti, now to a new store that caters to graffiti artists. Less than a month after opening its doors, Alpha Beta in Brooklyn is already facing criticism. NPR's Margot Adler reports on Alpha Beta's opponents and how the store is trying to stay on the right side of the law.
Graffiti is unwelcome in many communities, but it has a long history. There's evidence of graffiti in ancient Greece and Rome, and what were those cave paintings anyway? Charlie Halsey is a co-founder of the graffiti art store and gallery Alpha Beta.
I guess it's a primal instinct, really. Who knows why people, you know, write on the wall or you know, where that instinct comes from. I think it's, as far as I know, it's been being done since the dawn of mankind.
The store has only been open 3 weeks. It doesn't have a phone number or a website, but you can find it mentioned on blogs. The store itself is a single airy room on Greenpoint Avenue in Brooklyn with locked metal cages to hold the aerosol cans.
That is part of the fire code. To display spray paint in a store, you need to have it locked in a metal cage. Any combustible materials need to be locked in a metal cage.
There are racks of T-shirts for sale and hats covered with aerosol art and all kinds of dead stock sneakers from the 80s and 90s that were popular with hip-hop culture and graffiti artists. And outside is a large art space with two lovely murals on the walls. But already the shop has come under fire from Councilman Peter Vallone, for whom the eradication of graffiti is a personal mission.
We're not naive. This store was not established to cater to legal graffiti art because there's just not enough of that to turn a profit anywhere. Don't fall for this graffiti is art thing. You know, 85% of graffiti is just tags, nothing anyone will look at and say remotely artistic. Another 10% is gang communication. This is our neighborhood. This is our meeting place. Then there's a small percentage that you and I would look at and say, hey, if this kid were pointed in the right direction, he might have some talent.
Councilman Vallone came of age in the 1970s when graffiti became associated with New York's rising crime rate and the deterioration of neighborhoods. So he sees it as a gateway crime that sends a message to criminals that lawlessness is tolerated. Yet graffiti has always had a double edge, the etched and destroyed window on the one hand and, on the other, the stunning city mural or subway car that fueled a cultural awakening. Andrew Michael Ford is the director of the Ad Hoc Art Gallery in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is devoted to art that is often marginalized by the New York art scene, street art, pop surrealism, tattoo art. He says when the Tate Modern in London has graffiti artists painting the building, you know street art has come of age.
If they're doing it, I think it's just like the beginning. I think it just sent a wave around the world where it's like it's pretty much legitimate, relevant, on the map, and people need to pay attention to it. And you're going to see it in all the museums really soon, and we're just glad to be a part of it.
Charlie Halsey, the co-founder of Alpha Beta, says both views have some truth to them. He's seen almost a dozen graffiti supply stores in New York open only to crash and burn. Badly managed, flouting the laws. That's why he says Alpha Beta will be as much a gallery and event space as a store. In 3 weeks, they've already had five events when I arrive at a party sponsored by Overspray, an international graffiti art magazine. I find eight Austrian artists painting murals on three of the walls. They're all part of an exhibit by the Inoperable Gallery in Vienna. The gallery was founded by a 24-year-old American named Nicholas Platzer, who says he once was an illegal graffiti writer who got arrested when he was a teen.
My mom would have heart attacks when she'd get the 4 o'clock phone calls and stuff like that. And I sort of decided to go legal and promote the other artists.
His mom was there looking proudly on. A German artist who goes by the single name Franke stops painting a mural for a moment to say he's just having fun. The real graffiti artists, he says, are in dictatorships where writing on a wall is a courageous act.
So what I do now is like a child's play. But a real graffiti artist risks a lot to make people think, maybe.
As I look at his mural forming and the other two murals that are being painted that day, I realize the two lovely murals I saw here 2 days ago have vanished. Painted over, gone into the ether like some Tibetan sand painting. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
And you can see pictures of those murals at Alpha Beta on our website. That's at npr.org.
Here's one way that Hurricane Katrina altered New Orleans. Tens of thousands of Latino immigrants, some legal, some not, poured into the city. They wanted a chance for rebuilding work. Those newcomers led Mayor Ray Nagin to ask this.
How do I make sure
that New Orleans is not overrun by Mexican workers.
That was Mayor Nagin weeks after the hurricane. His office said he regretted his choice of words, but the sentiment was widely shared, then and now. NPR's David Green has the latest report in our series on the Latino vote.
One thing you notice in New Orleans these days is a lot more Mexican restaurants. I stopped at one for dinner with two longtime New Orleans residents named Martha Marilanda and Albert Stein.
Parrillada, parrillada. That's what we're going to eat, the parrillada.
Martha and Albert are originally from Colombia. Albert is a contractor, and he's hired a lot of Latinos since Hurricane Katrina.
They don't speak the language. Maybe they don't have transportation, but damn it, they're working.
He says something different about his black employees.
You hire the African Americans, they all want the easy way out. They don't work long hours. They always want breaks. They're not loyal.
Albert seemed to know his views would raise hackles.
It's a delicate issue. I mean, and I don't want to make it sound like it's a racial thing, but I think it's just an environment that we live in, you know, that it is what it is.
Martha Marilanda says she's seen too many Latinos become targets. They may be robbed as they're coming home from working on a construction site. She says she worries that if Barack Obama is president, there will be more crime and more tension.
You know, you cannot be better than them because they want your stuff, whatever you have. They want it, they take it. And, you know, just imagine with a black president, they're going to start jumping on us in a worse way. That's the way that I see it, unfortunately.
As we finished dinner, Martha and Albert stressed that they didn't want to seem racist. They said they're being honest about the climate in their community. Outside a coffee shop not far from the French Quarter, I sat down with Melissa Francis, an African-American born and raised in the city. She says she's always loved the diversity.
New Orleans has a history of being a gumbo pot. Everybody just come here and, you know, make one big pot of gumbo.
The pot's different now, Melissa says. She and her family returned to the city after Katrina, and one change since the storm is there's a Latino family living next door. They're good neighbors, Melissa says, although she doesn't hang out with them much.
Not just because they're Latinos or Hispanic people or Mexicans, it's because that's how it is. You know, you just got to take care of yourself right now, you know?
Melissa tells me she welcomes anyone to her city. Then she talks about a few frustrations. For one, she says employers have been hiring Hispanic immigrants at low wages, and that, she says, hurts everyone.
If I was an employer and I can get people in to work for me for kibbles and bits, they coming in. And that's sad. That's the sad part.
Melissa also objects to something else.
The only thing I have a little pet peeve about is when I find Hispanics using their language as an excuse to get out of work. And if they tell me not speak no English, I'll be like, you know, hey, you understand money?
You hear this kind of talk around town, says Martin Gutierrez. He's director of neighborhood and community services for Catholic Charities. And he saw Katrina change the city's mix of races almost overnight.
Most of the workers who are here in town perhaps are not aware of the struggles that the African-American community went through to get to where they are.
For blacks, it meant a new look to some neighborhoods.
There's always the fear of the unknown. And when you see new people in your neighborhood, when you see new people in your workplace, well, obviously, it's going to take some time to get used to those new faces in town.
My last stop on the trip was a meeting with Charles Teamer at a New Orleans landmark.
We're in the Camellia Grill, which is a famous New Orleans diner. It's been here forever. The wait staff is famous. You know, like a lot of places in New Orleans, the locals have their favorite waiter that they go to.
I got two islands. You got that shelf and the one bacon cheese, one turkey cheese.
As we downed breakfast, Charles talked to me about growing up in New Orleans and how he's watched Latinos help rebuild his city. He says he has a lot of respect for them.
You know, gutting houses and stuff is dirty work. You know, it takes a certain amount of chutzpah, whatever you want to call it, so.
If respect goes both ways, Charles says, blacks and Latinos can confront their struggles together.
Really, at the bottom line, I think the two communities have too much in common. And I think they'll make a mistake if we wind up, you know, being pitted against each other.
The key, he says, is getting past the fear.
You know, if you're worried about me reaching in for your wallet, then you're not going to want to have a casual conversation with me. So you won't know how nice I am.
We've been listening to that report from NPR's David Greene, and David's back from New Orleans, and he joins us. David, those are some pretty raw emotions, but New Orleans has had particular problems. So is that same tension across the country?
I mean, it is important to stress that this is just one snapshot in a city that is dealing with a lot the last few years. And you know, we only spoke to a few people, but I think this speaks to what has been an issue and continues to be an issue. And, you know, during the Democratic primary, Barack Obama struggled to win over Latinos. And one reason was this history of Black-Latino tensions in some places. And so I think that we were getting just a sampling of that.
So in the presidential contest, Obama has a little different problem than McCain. How does he deal with it?
You know, in the short term, I think it's a reminder for him that he needs to think about that he can't necessarily count on Latino voters because some might not be comfortable with him, and it may be because of race. And, you know, now polls show him winning the Latino vote right now over John McCain. I mean, it's pretty close to 2-1, so he's doing well, it seems. But, Deb, what we saw in New Orleans, it really is a reminder that Blacks and Latinos have something in common, and that's a real high incidence of economic hardship. And that's what, in some ways, I took from this. It's really the source of the tension in New Orleans. There's this competition at the bottom of the economic ladder, and the reality is that within this economic vote, there are competing elements, there are different groups with different views of their own situation, and they'll all be demanding the next president's attention. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you very much, David Green.
Pleasure, Deb.
Inflation is now a major concern for economic policymakers and for just about everyone else. But what goes on behind a price increase, and how do businesses cope with the pressure of rising prices? Well, with those questions in mind, I went to the Midwest last week to look at one consumer product, one that inflates in more ways than one. Popcorn. At the Van Wert Cinema 5 in rural northwestern Ohio, moviegoers who pay $6 for a ticket will gladly pay anything from $1.75 to $3.75 for a bag of popcorn.
You want butter on the popcorn?
Transactions like that one are going on in movie theaters all over the country. Theater owner Jim Boyd has owned theaters in Van Wert, Ohio for almost 20 years. Over that time, many things have changed about his business. But one thing that hasn't changed is the value of popcorn.
Quite frankly, popcorn pays the bills. With our gross receipts from ticket sales, we have potentially a break-even proposition. To make a living, I sell popcorn.
These days, Jim Boyd, like movie theater owners everywhere, is under pressure to raise his popcorn prices. That's because the price he pays has gone up so much.
A 50-pound bag of popcorn now is right at $18 a bag. I started the season at just under 12.
There has been a 50% increase. To find out why, we went first to Agricola Farms, just a few miles from the movie house. Agricola is owned by Dale and Charles Proffitt, two brothers in their 60s. Dale Proffitt walked me through one of his cornfields. We were literally up to our eyeballs in popcorn.
This is the kind of corn we like to see, right here.
Charles Proffitt taught me lesson number one about popcorn. These plants are different from ordinary corn.
The kernels are small, and they are round. Popcorn has a unique characteristic, the pericarp, which is the outside skin, and that's what holds the moisture inside the kernel, and when you apply the heat, that pops the pericarp, and that's how you get popcorn.
Popcorn is a specialty crop. There isn't a big enough market to create a popcorn price, like the prices of other commodities on the Chicago Board of Trade. So the price of popcorn rises and falls with the Chicago price of corn. That price has tripled over the past couple of years, largely because of the new demand for corn to make ethanol. So the price that Dale Prophet can charge for his popcorn has gone up too. He says so have his costs.
Our fuel increases from 07 to 08, and of course we haven't bought all of our fuel for 08 yet, but right now it's a 52% increase over what we purchased in 07. Mm-hmm. Our fertilizer costs, we basically use three different basic ingredients when it comes to fertilizer.
And they've all gone up by double-digit increases this year. As for next year, the increases are stunning. For potash?
108% from this year to 09.
And for nitrogen and phosphorus?
101% increase.
And for anhydrous?
At least a 54% increase.
Wow. Now, when I asked Dale Prophet why those costs are going up, he pointed out first that fertilizer is petroleum-based. The high price of oil is at work here, too. But he also described the agricultural economy that he and his brother work in and that we all live in. The Prophets may farm in a remote corner of northwestern Ohio. The closest big city is Columbus, and that's more than a two-hour drive away. But this is a small world.
A lot of these fertilizers are being consumed by China and India, and they're trying to increase their production so they can feed their population, and that just radiates through the whole world economy, and we're part of that world economy.
They're also part of the ethanol economy, even though popcorn is not used for ethanol. Now, why should the Prophet brothers benefit from a price increase for ordinary corn that is used for ethanol? Well, the short answer is land. Popcorn growers need a price that makes it sensible for them to keep growing popcorn on their farm instead of growing ordinary corn. Chris Hurt is an agricultural economist at Purdue University.
Popcorn and regular commercial corn and most of our other crops, soybeans, wheat, rice, compete for land. So when ethanol prices are high, when ethanol producers can pay more for corn, the competition for that land is intense. And so popcorn producers have to get a higher return because they can produce commercial corn.
So the round yellow kernels that go from Agricola and other farms to our next stop, the Weaver popcorn plant in Van Buren, Indiana, cost a lot more this year than they did last. And Weaver popcorn's freight bills are higher this year because of oil prices. The challenge to Chief Operating Officer Will Weaver is to look for every conceivable efficiency to keep the cost of his popcorn and his biggest single product, microwave popcorn, cheap.
How does your seed perform in the field? How much paper does it require to make one microwave popcorn pouch? How much adhesive? I mean, all throughout the entire process, we really need to make sure we're fighting to keep our costs in line because at the end of the day, that consumer is demanding a reasonably priced microwave popcorn pouch. So it's part of the fun of it, actually.
Weaver Popcorn is the world's number two popcorn maker after the big diversified food company Conagra. Weaver accounts for about 30% of production. It's a family business that started when Will's great-grandfather, Reverend Ira Weaver, started popping in 1928. Nearly half the popcorn market is overseas, so Weaver Popcorn is export-minded.
If we could just get everyone in China to eat one pouch of popcorn, you know, it'd be great.
This is a sophisticated, highly automated business. When Japanese customers complained about the uneven color of the popcorn, Weaver installed an optical sorting device which checks the color kernel by kernel. Some seeds produce tender kernels that mushroom out and show lots of surface area. They're ideal for dipping in caramel. Other seeds produce kernels that expand much more, and that's the popcorn best suited to overtop the bags sold at the movie theater. Here's an idea to fight inflation. Put fewer kernels of corn in each bag.
Well, as long as they pop and fill the bag, most consumers expect about 3 liters of popcorn in their popcorn bag.
I mean, that's that even without volume. Having the number, dissatisfaction sets in below that level.
Below that, and there's questions, eyebrows go up, and above that, it's probably too big anyway.
These people know their business. Weaver faces another inflationary pressure down the road. As consumer prices rise, the wage demands of his workforce will rise, and he says Weaver Popcorn needs its highly trained workers. Will Weaver is 36, and he admits that this inflationary cycle is something new to him.
For people of my generation, we are in uncharted waters. So The big concern I have is, you know, can we get this leveled off and get this thing back in check?
Oh, Wally, yeah. $6.
Back at the Van Wert, Ohio movie theater, proprietor Jim Boyd wants the same thing. He has seen inflation before, but not like this.
I can never remember this radical an increase in popcorn price.
$18 for 50 pounds of Weaver Gold, a 50% increase over 6 months. A big chunk of that increase gets added on after the popcorn leaves the Weaver plant. A theater concession supplier trucks it up along with other supplies all the way from Indianapolis. His price has to cover his astronomical bill for diesel fuel. Now, even at $18, those kernels have been bred for popping large the way racehorses are bred for running fast. We did the math. Pop 1 pound of kernels at a cost of 36 cents, and you get enough popcorn to fill 6 jumbo bags and make back the $18 cost of that whole 50-pound bag. Popcorn is still hugely profitable. So, when does Mr. Boyd increase his price?
Well, I'm kind of hung on a $20 bag of popcorn, and we're getting very close. I would hope to be able to hold a line at least through this year.
The AMC theater chain has increased its popcorn prices nationwide by 25 cents. The CEO of Regal Cinemas says a price increase is likely in his chain. These days, the price of popcorn has Jim Boyd reciting a lesson that he learned about the business from the theater owners he first worked for 40 years ago.
Find a good location to build a popcorn stand and build a theater around it.
When I was in Ohio and Indiana last week, I also looked into an interesting trend, the problems facing ethanol plants. Ethanol plants have been opening up all over the Corn Belt since 2006. They've been part of a boom as corn has been diverted from the food supply to automotive fuel. Well, now ethanol plants are often slow to open or they're facing possible closure.
I'll tell you, we're on the edge right now. We are one bad day of ethanol pricing away from having to decide to shut the plant down.
A look at ethanol now that the gold rush is over. That's tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Shortly before the Tour de France, there was an event you might call the Tourist de France. Amateur bike riders attempted a mountainous stage of the ride. It was stage 10, the portion of the race that the pros are riding today. The everyday bikers who tried for themselves include Phil McGlade. He's an Australian accountant who paid a tour group thousands of dollars for the privilege of getting really sore.
My legs are extremely sore. They're very tight. I haven't been able to go in for a massage, but my wife, sort of, who didn't ride, managed to somehow slip in a massage.
Unless she had more time.
I'm sort of something out there.
Now, I'm looking at a map of the different stages of the Tour de France, and stage 10, in terms of miles, looks pretty short, but it's way down in southwestern France in what must be the mountains, the Pyrenees.
That's exactly right. There's two major mountain sections in the Tour de France, the Pyrenean climbs and the Alp climbs. And the Pyrenean climbs tend to be a lot longer. One took me about almost 2 hours to climb up, and the other one took about an hour 15.
2 hours on a bicycle going uphill.
2 hours on a bicycle going uphill in a lot of pain. It was pretty tough.
How many of you were doing this stage, stage 10, all at once?
There were 9,000 people. I've never seen so many bikes in one location.
9,000.
9,000 people, which is absolute bedlam. But the really, really good thing was we were able to slot right in front of the other 8,900 people. It was absolutely fantastic.
Although, of course, then you're going uphill with 8,000 some people chasing you.
Yeah, exactly right. It's sort of, you sort of have to pick up the pace a little bit, but that's good.
How many hours did it take you to do the stage?
It was 7 hours, 58 minutes and 30 seconds. It was a long time to spend on a bike, that's for sure.
So when you're in some of these long climbs, what's the road like?
It's a really, really good atmosphere. There's people to the side of the road giving you some encouragement, you know, sort of the local people there with their kids and their grandparents cheering you on. I mean, we're all suffering, but there's a really nice bond there.
Are you on the edges of some cliffs here and there?
Yeah, absolutely. Halfway up the climb, you could look out and see some of the valley floors, but then we actually climbed into the cloud lines, so the visibility probably dropped to about 40, 50 meters, but it was beautiful countryside, fantastic people.
Are you a serious cyclist, Mr. McGlade?
I train about 12 to 13 hours per week, and I've done a couple of Ironman races, but certainly not the level of the Tour de France riders, that's for sure.
Well, just to understand where you are in relation to them, you finished this stage in a little under 8 hours. What would a Lance Armstrong kind of time be on that stage?
Lance Armstrong, I believe, did the same stage, and he was around 5 hours or something like that.
Just because of the Tour de France and because of the scandals, I have to ask if part of the experience was you got to do a drug test.
If I had had a test like that, it would have shown up absolute copious amounts of red wine partaken the previous few days. But the days after would have been far, far worse. Lots of red wine.
Phil McGlade, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Phil McGlade is an accountant who spends his leisure time biking uphill. Thank you.